Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. David Ansell, Chief Medical Officer at Rush University Medical Center, about bias, Black lives, and academic medicine.
An important topic, Christy, and I think one that you and I were committed to. And know that this is important not just in the way that African Americans, minorities are getting treated in the justice and the criminal system, but also in healthcare and academic healthcare, which is our backyard, and that what do we need to be doing to eliminate health disparities that are really hurting Black lives and other minorities.
I know. I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, we have some research that matters to talk about. One is, can too much sitting make you anxious?
I'm sitting here right now, but I'm not as anxious as I could be, but I may get there. But second, what about, speaking of disparities, do white men get better treatment for atrial fibrillation than women or minorities?
Probably. But we'll see what it says. Brain scans suggest that there's a link with recurrent depression and a certain part of the brain and its size called the hippocampus. Just sounds fun to say.
Can't wait to talk about the hippocampus. Absolutely. And finally, Christy and I will come honest. Have we ever come to the office while feeling a little bit too sick? And is that a common experience that doctors do? And is it even right? Let's dive right in about sitting in anxiety. And, you know, this isn't too surprising, Christy, because we know that being sedentary or sitting or laying down is not really great for your overall health other than when you're sleeping.
Right. And we also know that anxiety is super common. It's about 1/6 of adults and teens have an anxiety disorder.
1/6. 1 out of 6.
Yeah. That's in Australia where this some of the study was done. But anxiety is a serious illness, and we see it very commonly in the United States as well. And this is looking at the journal BMC Public Health, where they did a systematic review of 9 different international studies.
Yeah, and basically what they found is that there is this strong relationship between this prolonged sitting and anxiety. Now, that is not cause and effect necessarily, because if one feels anxious, perhaps one doesn't want to get up and do exercise. But there's a lot of truth probably behind this idea that physical activity and mood are really strongly linked, and the absence of physical activity certainly could be linked with deteriorating mood. Again, important issues.
Right, and it's sort of chicken or the egg. Maybe people are staying inside and more sedentary because they're anxious, or maybe they're more anxious because they're sitting.
Chicken or eggs? I thought chickens crossed the road.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I guess they sit on the egg.
That's what I'm saying. Which came first?
Too long, that could be anxiety. But we
take
do
it into
think that
a new level.
An important issue, and I think clinically, Christy, where this would go is to understand that as people become anxious, if their physical activity goes down, we might want to really focus on continuing to be physically active as one
as
of the
a part of it,
and maybe trying to avoid this. It can't hurt to do that.
Absolutely. Let's talk next about disparity in treatment of atrial fibrillation, or a type of abnormal heartbeat that's very common here in the United States.
Yeah, this was actually in the journal Heart Rhythm, and it's not really different in many ways from what we're going to be talking about with our guest today, Dr. Ansell, about disparities. And this in particular one is that women, African Americans, and Hispanics were less likely to get some of the treatments that are indicated in guidelines for atrial fibrillation. In particular, women were less likely to get a blood thinner, which is recommended.
Right. The women were less likely than men to get blood thinners to prevent a stroke, which is the risk from atrial fibrillation. But also women, Blacks, and Hispanics are less likely to get something called a catheter ablation, which is like a surgical procedure that can bring the heart back to its normal rhythm and thereby reduce some of the other effects from having atrial fibrillation.
So the important piece here is that these biases into why are women and other minorities that are getting some of these treatments less likely, and the white men in this case are getting the preferred treatment. These are some implicit biases in the healthcare system, and our guest today will hopefully give us some good ideas on what we can do as leaders, as providers, as researchers to understand and eliminate this. Mm-hmm. Speaking of kind of eliminating or treating things, our next research that matters that was in the journal Molecular Psychiatry was about recurrent depression in an area of the brain called the hippocampus.
So what they found was that people with major depression, particularly those who had recurrent major depression, so it happened several times in their life, had a smaller hippocampus, this part of the brain, than other people who didn't have recurrent depression.
And they looked at 1,700 people with major depression and about 7,200 people who didn't have this. And they noticed that two-thirds of the participants with major depression had had recurring symptoms. And those that had the recurring symptoms had this smaller hippocampus. And it suggests that if we can keep that hippocampus from deteriorating, that we might be able to prevent recurrent depression. That's a might. But it suggests we should treat depression early. That's a no-brainer.
A no-brainer, no pun intended. But also, I mean, this is one of those things where maybe if your hippocampus is different, you can't do a whole lot about it. But it's another piece of this puzzle of what causes depression and what kinds of effects depression can have on the brain. So further study is needed.
In this case, a bigger hippocampus is better.
How do I grow my hippocampus?
Another research another time. Last research that matters very quickly, it was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal Pediatrics, about the majority of doctors, 80%, treating patients while they're sick. Have we ever done that, Christy?
Absolutely, yes. And there is a culture. I tell you, there is a culture, and we all know it's true, where doctors, you got to show up to work. As residents and when we're in training, you have to show up, and there's sort of like a unwritten badge of honor to continuing to work even when you're sick. I think that's changing some, and now we've noticed more of our providers still showing up but wearing masks or other things to protect the patients.
And I just want to send those doctors home when they've got those masks on. Like, I'll cover for you. I'll work twice as hard. I wonder if patients want that. I think that's the next
area. I'm sure they do.
What do patients want? Do they want the doctor working with the mask, or they want them going home?
Well, the doctor is worried partly that they're going to disappoint their patients who have arranged their schedules and made all this effort to get there to their appointment, and then for them not to show up. So then you're sort of weighing out, how sick am I?
Physician, heal thyself.
That's a good point.
Well, we've had a great chance to talk about research that matters today, about disparities in healthcare for atrial fibrillation,
about scans suggesting recurrent depression might take a toll on the brain,
about sitting in anxiety. You could probably do better by getting more active.
And about doctors admitting to coming and treating patients while they're sick.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. David Ansel about bias, black lies, and academic medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. David Ansel, Chief Medical Officer at Rush University Medical Center, about bias, black lives, and academic medicine, and a recent article that he just published in the New England Journal of Medicine of the same title.
Welcome, Dr. Ansel. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, tell us just a little about your background and what sparked your interest in physician and health advocacy.
Yeah, in my clinical time, I'm a primary care doctor, general internist. And my background is I went to medical school in upstate New York and was at the time, you know, somewhat shocked at the nature of healthcare in America, and that led me to go do training in in Chicago at Cook County Hospital, which is one of the largest public hospitals in the country. And I stayed there for 17 years and then spent 10 years at a large safety net in Chicago called Sinai Health System, where I was chair of internal medicine. And then a decade ago came to Rush to be a chief medical officer. And, you know, ironically, all three hospitals are on the same street. And, you know, I observed just the inequities in health and healthcare that were quite obvious to me and my patients on that one street. I call it three hospitals, one street, two worlds.
And the sorts of things you witnessed were what?
Well, just, you know, aspects of outcomes that were just not achievable sometimes, not because of the doctors and the nurses, but because of the systems, how systems have been set up to actually keep people from achieving the kind of health and healthcare outcomes that they deserved. And I saw that both from my experiences as a primary care doctor and a safety net, but also from my patient's perspective. When I got to the academic medical center down the street, and suddenly it was different options and opportunities for care. I like to give this example, is that in my 17 years at Cook County Hospital and my 10 years at Mount Sinai in Chicago, I may have had one or two people who got a joint replacement. And I got to my current place at Rush, which is an academic medical center, and it's a top-ranked orthopedic program. And they literally, you can limp into the front door and within a few weeks get evaluated. And that's how disparity works, and one aspect of inequity works. And I've seen it in my patients. The same could be said around who needs a transplant and who gets it. But the other area, which has been an area of my research, has been breast cancer disparity. And when you look at black-white gaps in breast cancer outcomes and look at it nationally, these gaps are oftentimes due to variability in quality of care that one can get in one system versus another, driven many times by other factors, like what's going on in the community. My observations from moving from one institution to another was really much of this is hardwired in, and of course much is hardwired into the physicians and nurses who take care of these populations as well.
So maybe walk us through an example as you're thinking about breast cancer disparities and differences in outcomes for blacks versus whites. Walk us through those steps that might be factors in those outcomes being so different.
Yes. Well, when I got done with my residency at Cook County Hospital and we were seeing so much end-stage disease, I decided that if I was going to stay on as a primary care physician, that I wanted to do something that had to do with prevention or early detection, and got involved with very early on setting up breast cancer screening program and making mm-hmm. sure women were getting linked from primary care to screening to diagnosis to treatment. And in those days, it was in the mid-1980s, you know, it was the rise of adjuvant chemotherapy, the advent of screening, while controversial, probably played some role in reducing mortality. And what we found is as more and more women were getting screened, we were able to find earlier cancers. But what we found in Chicago as a whole, and it turns out nationally, that over time, the benefits of all of these advances really benefited white women, more particularly than black women. In fact, in Chicago, we saw mortality didn't budge from 1980 to 2007. Whereas the white mortality went down very nicely. When we first put this out, people said, well, it's biological. Black women get worse breast cancers. They're more undifferentiated. They're larger. Their receptors tend to be more negative and poorer prognostically than in white women. But what we were able to do was show that the high mortality areas in Chicago were the areas with the worst access to care. Mm. And when we went back and began to measure the quality of care, for example, for this one disease element in these community areas and the institutions, there were gaps in quality. And so what oftentimes we view as perhaps, you know, defects within the woman, say biological, were actually more stark defects within the systems of care that were set up that served underserved populations. And what we found with breast cancer, because breast cancer in some ways is a canary in the coal mine of how our healthcare system works. It requires you to have a medical home. Your doctor has to be able to refer you for screening. The screening has to be of high quality. They have to have a diagnostic setup in place. There has to be access to specialists to do treatment. And it requires a lot of a woman, and we're not celebrating, you know, how well it is for white women in this country. It's just at every step of the way, we found women, black women in particular, minority women, poor women were falling through the cracks. And this falling through the cracks led to worse breast cancer outcomes.
Well, Dr. Ansel, I wanted just to ask you that the scenario that you're laying out here, and Christy and I know this, we read research report after research report about worse health outcomes across all these types of diseases. And it's not like we can work disease by disease by disease, though we try to do that at times to eliminate these disparities. Is that what led in part to what I think is a justifiable protest on campuses, medical school campuses across the country, for healthcare professionals to join in this Black Lives Matter, which is the disparity is injustice, but we are now having to really deal with the disparities in our own shop? Same issue?
Exactly. I think you've nailed it on the head. One can go through any kind of disease entity and find the same kind of gaps that, say, we found with breast cancer. And it was an interesting thing when the students went out, and it was 70 medical schools around the country that went out at the exact same time to really commemorate Michael Brown murder and Eric Garner. The call to action was for the academic medicine, but really the whole healthcare system, to do a self-examination of the bias and the inequities in our midst, not only sort of the things that are in the curriculum that could lead to perhaps worse educational outcomes that affect the care that patients get, but really in the administrative policies and decisions. And the call for action asked for an examination of bias within our systems. And so what we found at our institution is that there was pushback, not only from students, but professors, and says, what does the killing of Michael Brown have to do with public health? And it was an interesting question because, you know, many of us felt it had everything to do with public health. And that led to me writing that piece. Ed McDonald in the New England Journal on the issue of bias in academic medicine.
Right. Well, we're glad you did. And there's so many questions that we have. We need to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. David Ansel, Chief Medical Officer at Rush University Medical Center, about bias, Black lives, and academic medicine. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. David Ansel, Chief Medical Officer at Rush University Medical Center, about bias, Black lives, and academic medicine. And before the break, Dr. Ansel, you were talking to us about health disparities and some examples and analysis of the different factors that can go into that. But I wonder if we could talk a bit about the importance of diversity in our medical education and in our medical providers that may shed light or help build trust or certainly reflect more of our patient population in our nation as we're moving and looking for ways to improve the gaps in care. What are the biggest challenges for us in getting more a more diverse group of medical professionals?
Yes, that's a great question, and I think there's a lot that goes into this. But you know, if you reflect on these killings of young black men that we've seen across the country, a lot was raised about police and bias. And I think the reflection back into healthcare is saying, how is bias, whether it be explicit, but more often implicit, it's unconscious. We're not aware of the biases within ourselves that could be actually leading to disparities. And some of this has to come also with how do we recruit young people and from really varied backgrounds to come into medicine? And how well do our recruitment processes address the idea that when you do tests of implicit bias, meaning unconscious bias, in really across the country, that 70% of us, and sometimes more, up to 85%, have evidence that we have unconscious preference for whites over blacks. And again, this is probably due to stereotyping and things that occur from TV and the news, but actually as much of a factor as the fact that in our daily lives, we actually live fairly segregated lives, where we don't have in our day-to-day discourse much in the way of relationships with people from other backgrounds than us. This can affect recruitment. It can affect retention of faculty here. And we do a disservice to our patients in communities when we do not have some degree of representation in our professional workforces of the patients that we're serving. I'm not saying it has to be 100%, but we do a particularly bad job in medicine with with underrepresented in medicine minority groups. For example, black men there's very few black men in medicine. And in fact, if you look at the statistics on blacks in medicine, we haven't done much better in the past 30 years. We haven't really seen a lot of progress in this area. Latinos, the same kind of problem. Native Americans, it's very, very problematic. But the first place we have to look is inside ourselves. What more could we do? What are we doing that's wrong? And I think some of it has to do with the implicit bias in our system.
So it's important for myself as a white provider to be speaking out on this at all levels and phases, because it's not enough for us to have the policies that are out there recruiting. I mean, because it's you know, I'm having implicit bias clearly when I'm seeing patients. The research shows it, even if I don't think I am.
Yeah, that's true. And there are things that one can do, we think, to lessen that. And one is to actually get some training on, different cultural beliefs, but getting some training on the prevalence of implicit bias and how it affects decision-making. There are some studies out there that show that pain treatment for black versus Latino versus white patients is different. When they present to the emergency room, that who gets treated for pain seems to differ by race and ethnicity. So to a certain extent, those of us who come from white men and we have these implicit biases, and understanding them inside of ourselves can help to mitigate that. The flip side of it is trust of our patients. So, you know, the patients pick up on this as well, and the patients come with some degree of mistrust for all kinds of reasons. And so if you deal with both the potential for a doctor to have implicit bias and a chance for patients to mistrust, then how do you build the therapeutic relationship that's going to lead to healing?
And because my focus is in medical education and wanting to improve diversity among our physician trainees, I am struck at how few medical graduates there are from underrepresented minorities. And we all want to try to improve that, but there aren't very many coming through the pipeline. And so that suggests to me we need to be starting much earlier. And what kind of biases or disparities in educational opportunity or other things are going into our nation that are barriers for underrepresented minorities going through and really wanting to and being able to go through that pathway to become physicians and other medical providers?
Yes, that is having a pipeline of available students is a big deal. I think one can't sort of separate it from, you know, the realities of our society that, you know, those of us and who've been lucky enough to grow up in privileged backgrounds mm-hmm. and live in neighborhoods and have schools, you know, where our kids could get the best education. Many of these students are going to schools in neighborhoods that don't have either the best facilities or the best training, and we lose these kids very early on. And if you're, say, a black young man, you're way more likely to go to jail than to college. You know, Chicago, one out of every three black men, young men, will touch the criminal justice system at some point in their life. And that's the systems that we really do have to overcome and to begin to sort of create the opportunity for, you know, kids to move into healthcare careers. We got to get them early when they're in grade school and elementary school and high school into programs that are supportive and mm-hmm. nurturing.
Well, let's say a black student is one of the fortunate few that has made it through and made it to college and medical school and a residency program and then takes a faculty position. Is the struggle for equality over, or what are the challenges now that this black faculty member faces in an academic institution?
Well, the literature suggests that retention and recruitment and retention of black faculty is fairly dismal in the United States. And if you look at sort of promotion and who gets promoted or not, women and black people are much less likely to get promoted to up the academic ranking scale than, for example, white men. So there is, you know, within our own institutions and departments, bias. And it's a very lonely feeling. Our students and our faculty tell us, you know, at Rush, which is a private university in Chicago, Chicago's a third black, a third Latino, and a third white, that they feel alone, that while they feel welcome and people are friendly, there's not necessarily always the kind of, you know, feeling of being included. And it's because people want to see more folks like themselves. So we're not doing, across academic medicine, a very good job of either recruiting, but once we recruited, retaining and promoting our faculty. A lot has to do with mentorship and who are the mentors and how do you make that happen. But it can be done. It just requires us all to dig deeper.
Well, as we are wrapping up this conversation, this is one of those things where you sort of look and you're like, wow, it's so sad that at this point in our history, we have so much disparity in healthcare in our nation. As we look at this and look to encourage young people in their education and opportunity and to own up and try to reconcile our own biases and how to overcome that, what do you think the most important next steps are for us as we look ahead to make headway in these problems?
I think it's really important for those of us who are in privileged position, either by our positions or our gender, our ethnicity and race, to speak up. I do think this is about white men in medicine speaking up to acknowledge the gaps, because it's not just the racial gap, there are gender gaps, there's LGBT gaps as well. Mm-hmm. That we have to overcome. But it starts by, you know, those who are in the privileged positions to be able to speak up about it and do some self-reflection. But I think actively training faculty in the sort of the idea that there is unconscious bias, it does exist, just the same way that police need to go through training in the United States as well on the issues of bias. I do think those of us in medicine who are who have the responsibility for training the next generation need to undergo this training as well.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Ansel, for helping spark our listeners, sparking us, the challenge to many of us to do more and to speak out. Thank you for your advocacy on behalf of Your Health listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We've been listening to Dr. David Ansel, Chief Medical Officer at Rush University Medical Center, about bias, black lives, and academic medicine. We're going to take a short break. When we return, Christy and I will be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. You know, Adam, that was a fascinating conversation with Dr. Ansel, and one that really is disheartening in many ways, to think that there continue to be such gaps in the quality of care, the access of care that we have across our nation, across ethnic diversity.
You know, we've made greater progress in reducing overall levels of poor health, but the gaps still are there. And I think until we hit the underlying causes, we're not going to really make as much progress. And I was just thinking, Christy, during the break about, you know, the recruitment of minorities into medicine, and what ages should we be recruiting and what are we doing? I mean, you know, I maybe give a talk once a year to some college students, but, you know, we need to be
starts earlier
there.
Than that.
Yeah. I mean, we're, you know, college coaches are recruiting for basketball in the fifth and sixth grade. Shouldn't we be recruiting for scientists at an early age?
We should. We should. I mean, we need to really think about this as a nation and approach this from multiple different angles. Thinking about, I mean, this goes into education and schools and health and lots of different factors. And then to see it bear out in such shocking ways in health outcomes is it's sad.
You know, I would encourage our listeners, if you have some special stories, some special thoughts about bias in medicine and racial bias in medicine, things you've experienced, things you've seen, things you want to kind of have us bring up on the show, let us know. And we'll bring them up in a future show and talk about them on our house calls. And we've actually got some interesting house calls on our show today, right?
We do. We get to spend a few minutes talking about the questions people have sent us, your concerns. And we want to remind you before we do these house calls to write us some house calls. Send them in to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we'll address them on an upcoming show.
And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first house call question about fungus of the toenail, or as we say, there's a fungus among us. What do we have, Daniel?
I have toenail fungus. It doesn't really bother me, but I'm not sure what will happen if I do nothing. Lamisil didn't help in the past, but I don't want to take the pills again.
Well, all right. Sounds like you've explored your options, and it doesn't bother you very much. I mean, my take on this, I'll be interested. I know you have a lot of expertise in dermatology, Adam. But my take on this is, if you've got some mild toenail fungus and it's not bothering you, and you don't really want to go through the treatment, so it's totally fine to just let it be there. You know, try to keep it clean and prevent, you know, having sores or infections in your feet. But if you've got a little fungus there, for most people, it doesn't bother them all that much.
Let it be, like the Beatles. Just let it be. But the problem is, for some people, is that it is cosmetically disfiguring.
Sure.
That's the problem here, is that for the most time, absolutely right, Christy, it does not hurt people. And so what can one do cosmetically? And there are some things. One can keep the toenail clip pretty short. That can get rid of a lot of the visible toenail fungus. If you're a woman, you can have your toenails painted. And you could have it done if you're a guy, too. But a lot of my guy friends don't do that as much as the women. And so the topical treatments, unfortunately, the things we see on TV that John McEnroe's pushing,
they don't work.
They work very poorly. They work, but they work very poorly. You got to use it every day for a year, and maybe 1 out of 10 toenails responds. That means 9 out of 10 don't. Not
right.
Great results. So, and the oral treatments cause liver problems for many people, and only about 50 to 60% effective. So learning to live with it, if it doesn't really bother you, probably the best advice.
Let's take our next house call question.
I'm in my 70s and I run half marathons. I love my shoes, but my left foot is starting to become more deformed, where the bony part at the base of my toe sort of sticks out and the big toe is turning in so that it runs into my second toe. I don't want to stop running and I don't want to change shoes. So do you have any suggestions?
Well, you know, I run half miles instead of half marathons.
I was going to say,
when I run those
wow.
half miles, my two toes also, my feet run into each other. But that's a different story.
Yeah. Let us first just say, wow, you're in your 70s. You're running half marathons. You're not eager to take a bunch of medicines if you don't have to. And I think that that says a lot about your health. And it's no surprise that there is some foot pain and maybe some deformity. It sounds like that's going on, some foot deformity.
It's possible bunion where the toes are starting to turn and the bones overgrowing and moving out abnormal. Sometimes that can happen. That can be painful and it can look like the toes are overlapping, but it's really the bunion kind of forcing that toe. Could be that.
It could. And it could be these shoes that you love, that there's something about them that are not, or either turning your toes or squishing your toes a little bit more in your shoes that's making it more uncomfortable when you run. And there could be, it sounds like you're not willing to change your shoes, but it might be worth at least exploring if there are shoes that could support your foot in a way that makes them not hurt so much.
Yeah, you know, one of my great mentors, Dr. Shoelace, told me, Christy, okay, I made the name up, but it was a great mentor. I just don't remember exactly who. Told me, though, that 90% of problems with the feet are problems with the shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a case where I would agree 100%, Christy, that you should go look and think about perhaps seeing a shoe specialist, maybe a
orthotics.
Foot specialist, someone who specializes in orthotics, a physical therapist, or even a podiatrist.
Yeah. Let's take our next house call question, Daniel.
My right shoulder has been hurting for a month. Nothing really started it, but maybe I was just carrying a heavy purse while traveling. I have taken a rare Advil and continue to play golf. I can do anything I need to do, but it just hurts sometimes. Does it seem okay to wait a few more weeks before going to the doctor?
Well, you've already waited a while, right?
Yeah.
What do you think, Christy?
Well, you know, it's tricky because it's not, if you're able to do all those things and you continue to play golf, but you don't want to go see the doctor just yet and you want to put it off a little while. You know, some of the things that your doctor will tell you when you go are to think about, like giving it some rest, some ice, some anti-inflammatories, which you started with the Advil, but if you're only taking one rarely, it's probably not giving you the inflammation assistance. But doing some of those things first, maybe resting it from the golf a little bit to give whatever's irritated in there a chance to heal. And if that doesn't work, I'd say, yeah, you got to go get it checked out.
I want to know, does it feel better when you hit a good golf shot? Because if it does, then maybe there's a different doctor you need to see for when you hit the bad golf shot and it feels worse. But assuming that it feels about the same all those times, I would worry a little bit about that it's been going on for a month and that there may be something else at play here, something sometimes we call frozen shoulder or adhesive capsulitis. But sometimes the shoulder can kind of develop a little scar tissue around it. And that's a subtle process. It comes along slowly. And the treatment for that actually would be physical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe seeing a physical therapist even before your doctor or getting your doctor to refer you may be indicated. Not an easy question, but we hope it doesn't get worse.
Let's take our last house call question for the day.
I'm 70 and I have a lump in my breast that I noticed 6 months ago. When I was a younger man, I had a cyst in the other breast that was removed by my family doctor. This feels similar, about the size of a lima bean. It's not painful, but should I get it checked out or just let it go?
Well, there's something called heuristics. That's a fancy term for, you know, what you've seen recently, you get worried about as a doctor. So if I've seen a case of heart disease when someone who's 40, when the next person who comes in is 40, even though it's not likely to be heart disease, I'm thinking heart disease. And unfortunately here, Christy, I've seen a male about this age recently who had breast cancer. So I worry about it more, even though breast cancer is rare in males.
It is. It is rare in males. And it sounds like you feel it's very similar to the cyst that you had in the past, which sounds like it must have been benign. It was taken out. You called it a cyst. But just because your age and that it's new and different, I think it's worth getting it checked out with some sort of imaging test, an ultrasound, a mammogram, something, just to kind of be sure that you're not missing something.
Yeah, a mammogram would be safe and would give a really good indication. And if there's any doubt, maybe an ultrasound and possibly even a biopsy. If they see it just looks like maybe fat and nothing worrisome, there could be some reassurance there. And they could probably detect that. So good question. And hopefully everything turns out just fine.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it, but I would get that checked out.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. We've had a good chance to talk about breast lesions in men.
About toenail fungus among us.
about those who are running and running half marathons better than me, but I'd love to strive for that, but go look at some shoes.
And about ongoing shoulder pain and physical therapy and anti-inflammatories and some rest.
Well, thank you all for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. Share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visiting us online at yourhealthradio.org, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. David Ansel. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.